Hello and a very warm welcome to Bruegel's podcast, The Sound of Economics. My name is Guntram Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Franziska Brandner from the Green Party. Franziska is not only a prominent member of the German parliament, the Bundestag, but she's also the spokesperson for Europe and has written on a variety of topics, including the topic which we want to discuss today, which is Europe's strategic sovereignty, what it all means, and what it means also for the role of the euro in Europe and in the world. Thank you so much, Franziska, for joining.
Thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
As our listeners have already heard, we want to discuss strategic sovereignty and then focus on the euro in particular. And of course, also hear about the plans of the Green Party that is now in the polls, the biggest party in Germany, and might even be the winner of the federal elections upcoming in September, possibly even putting up the next German chancellor. So very important party. And the views of the Greens will be very influential in the next German government. And therefore, it's quite interesting for our global audience to hear about one key issue that has been discussed now for quite some years, which is Europe's strategic sovereignty. And there's always been different views about what it actually means. Some have considered it to be more of a decoupling strategy from the US. Some think it's protectionism in disguise. Others argue it is about actually managing interdependencies. What is it for you, Franziska? How would you define strategic sovereignty, and how would you define European strategic sovereignty?
For us, European strategic sovereignty is not decoupling or getting isolated from the rest of the world, but it is the capacity to define as European Union common objectives and the capacity to achieve them together. It is the capacity to act in order to achieve and attain common objectives. It's also about more resilience within a network. The idea is exactly in an interdependent world to become resilient and to have the capacity to define our own future. That's how we define it.
And on a scale from 0 to 1, 0, no capacity to act and shape, and 10, perfect capacity to act and shape our relations, where do you see Europe currently and where would you like Europe to be?
It depends very much on the sector that you're looking at. I think it would be wrong if you would say the EU as such in general. We have areas where the EU is much better. We have discovered in the pandemic that, for example, in the health sector, we are quite dependent in some areas and we're not very resilient at the beginning of the crisis. So there are also areas that you discover where you want to be more resilient in times of crisis. So I think, you know, we still have quite a way to go when it comes to health, when it comes to climate energy, when it comes to digital, but also to a lesser extent, but still so when it comes to economic and financial questions.
We do want to focus on the economic and financial issues in a minute, but perhaps I want to push you a few minutes because I'm also particularly interested in the climate and energy field, where you see the main issues in the climate and energy field at the moment. I mean, we have a very ambitious Green Deal in place that will set Europe on a decarbonization path that is going to be fairly rapid. And all of that will, of course, have implications both for our trading partners that export energy to us, but also more generally to our trading partners, to the extent that we use carbon border adjustment to prevent carbon leakage and ensure that climate progress in Europe doesn't stop here, but really becomes a global project. So how strong will we be in this space? And, you know, what needs to still be done?
Yeah, I think it's important really, again, to remind that this is not an anti-American or anti-whoever agenda, but it's one of being able to define our future. And of course, one very important dimension of that is climate protection and decarbonization of our societies and our economies. And as you said, if we really mean this, we know that we need to have many, many new technologies to get there. And for example, when I know storage of energy is a key factor in achieving these goals. I cannot, as an EU, be completely dependent on the next generation of development of batteries on other countries. If I know that I need storage capacities and new technologies on that, I need to make sure that those who can develop these ideas are also based inside the EU. Because what today, much of this comes from China. What happens if tomorrow the Chinese government would decide we don't go into batteries anymore because we decided that climate protection is no longer our goal? Then we as Europeans could no longer go to the next generations of new technologies. And that's sort of the thinking that we have in mind. What kind of technologies, capabilities do we really need to have inside Europe to achieve a carbon neutral economy and society? And that's a long-term thinking. It's not just today and tomorrow, but that's the one dimension, which has, by the way, in the industrial policy dimension, of course, behind it in terms of what kind of technologies do we keep at home. And the second dimension that you talked about, which is also very important, is that whatever decisions we take will have ramifications on our partners, as you said. It's, by the way, not just energy. It's also palm oil, for example, producers. You know, if we decide to get out of this, what will it make to Indonesia, other countries? It's not just a fossil producing country so far. And we as Europeans have an interest in making that transition in other countries peaceful and also successful, which is not a given at all that the energy transition in the Middle East, North Africa will be easy or, you know, peaceful. But it's in our own interest to support that. And that then asks for the questions of, as you said, how do you then combine the needs of our own economic actors and the climate and other countries together? You already spoke about carbon leakage. That's the idea that we do manage to produce steel without CO2, but it will, of course, be more expensive than current CO2-filled steel. And then others would just import it. And then nothing would happen for the climate because the climate doesn't care if the steel is produced harmfully in Germany or somewhere else in this world. For the climate, it's no difference. So we would not have achieved anything for climate protection. We would just have killed European industries. And none of this is our goal. But the question is, how do you get there without entering a trade war? And I think that's where we propose sort of, you know, to go into an alliance now with the US and open it up on climate, to do it in a cooperative way and say, okay, this is our joint challenge, for example, on steel or cement. What kind of standards do we set? How can we do it cooperatively and to first try to do it with other actors? And if that doesn't fly, then to have a border adjustment mechanism as EU only.
Yes. And on that front, of course, the U.S. climate envoy, John Kerry, has by now finally signaled some willingness to move forward with the Europeans. And in our discussion in a recent event with U.S. Senator Whitehouse, we have also found quite a lot of common ground and discussed exactly this issue of, you know, forming a transatlantic alliance. And of course, as soon as you talk about a transatlantic alliance, you also talk about China and whether or not China is the one that is actually targeted by the alliance. China, of course, has itself set some goals, 2060 decarbonization, but it is not decarbonizing in the short to medium term. On the contrary, until 2030, the number of coal-fired power plants will grow rapidly. And so China is not at all decarbonizing. So there clearly is a friction point here between sort of the ambitious goals that the EU has set itself, Germany even more ambitious now, and the US on the one hand and China on the other hand. So how do you see that triangle?
I really believe that you should try to also do involve and cooperate with China on this and call them on their ambitious targets that they have set for the future. And they are part of the Paris Climate Convention. The goal is to open it up, by the way, not just China, Australia, other countries, really. I'm like, the best would be to do it within the WTO, but, you know, start and then get a sort of a climate club where you have those countries with ambition and where you can verify afterwards the production for certain products. And then you see who will be ready to join or not. And I think it's worth a try if then the Chinese Communist Party decides not to join. At least then you can say we tried and now we have a reason to put in a carbon leakage mechanism. But I think, you know, if you haven't even tried, then it would be a pity for the climate, because if we do achieve it, that's much better for the climate if China joins. Also, if it doesn't, at least you have proven that you were serious about making it an international approach.
Indeed. And sometimes the threat of being excluded works miracles and, you know, leads to agreement earlier on. But let's move the discussion to currency policies that you foresee for the European Union. You have called for a stronger international role of the euro, which is actually quite a change in the German debate, if I can say so, to our international audience. The European Central Bank has inherited basically the view of the Bundesbank, which was always, well, we do not promote our currency as an international currency, because having an international currency comes with duties and obligations, which the Bundesbank thought would not be advisable to assume. And so that tradition was very present in the European Central Bank, but the European Central Bank has recently, in the last few years, shifted its thinking, and also the European Commission and the European Council have called on the euro to play a stronger role. What is a stronger international currency for you, Franziska? How would you define it and how would you want to get there?
I think the first question is to ask, why do you need it or why would we want it?
Right.
Our reasoning behind this is that we have seen that currency is, of course, a tool to implement, exert your policy choices as a country. And we have seen in the years of President Trump that he has used the dollar, for example, for his Iran policy, so that European companies didn't follow European government's policy choices on Iran, but de facto followed American policy because they are just too exposed to the dollar risk. And that experience for us was one where we said, okay, this is in our neighborhood. It has immediate consequences for our security. We as Europeans have decided to go one way, and Trump decided to go the other way, and we cannot implement our policy because we have no international relevant currency that our companies can use. And that experience led us to really rethink the need of a more international role of the euro. And of course, we can all hope that we will never have again a Mr. Trump in the White House in the US. But I wouldn't bet on it. We will do everything we can in order to support a democratic, in not in the sense of a party, but of a democratic leader of the US. But I still think it's worthwhile considering a stronger role of the euro.
So indeed, the Iran policy and Trump, very strong motivation for strengthening the role of the euro. However, let me push you a little bit on this point, because there is often this view that if only we had a strong euro, we could have continued doing business with Iran. And I don't think it's quite that simple, right? Because a lot of our companies that were exposed to the dollar are also exposed to the US market. And so the US, of course, has more leverage than just the currency. It can also leverage its own market and impose pressure through secondary sanctions directly on companies without even the dollar debate.
Yeah, of course. You also need measures against secondary sanctions. And I'm very glad that the European Commission has proposed tools for that. So it doesn't solve the entire problem, but it's one of the conditions that you need to be able to act according to your policy choices.
So how do we get the euro to take off as an international currency?
The euro needs to become a full currency union anyhow. We all know that we have a joint currency that has not yet been completed by a fiscal union. We have been relying so far on the European Central Bank, mostly to save us in crisis. And in Germany, we have the sort of wrong assumption that you could have a currency union without a fiscal policy and with a central bank that has a limited mandate. And we know that a currency union doesn't fly with
these two conditions were coming together. And in addition, the German Constitutional Court has made very clear that the mandate of the European Central Bank is really a limited one. So that has added the pressure to really work on and think on the fiscal union side of the currency. And in the pandemic now, we have seen that we have luckily managed to set up the recovery fund, which is a fiscal response to a crisis, and that we were able, or we are going to be able now, to issue European bonds at the European Commission. You know, it's not a mutualization of debt, but it's a European debt. And I think that it would be a mistake to give up that capacity again to issue the bonds, and that we need to maintain this as one of the foundations for a more stronger international role of the euro. And the second point, which I think is interesting, and it's also linked to the recovery fund, is the issuing, for example, of green bonds and making this a stronger policy of the European Union and linking it to the objective of climate protection. And, for example, another avenue of how to do it precisely is to make sure that new future markets will be in euro, such as the emissions trading scheme, to not let this be taken over by other currencies, but to really ensure that we have enlarging markets in euro. So there are different avenues. It's not the one button you have to push and then you have a strong international currency, but certainly you need to fulfill the European Monetary Union with a fiscal and economic, of course, policy that is related to it. None of us is just proposing bonds without policy accompanying it and giving guidelines on how to spend it.
It's such a pleasure to hear actually a senior politician say things that, you know, I as an academic or others have said for 10 years. So thank you for saying some of these things and perhaps making them a political reality. But can I ask you really how to make this a reality? Because you mentioned, of course, one dimension is the legal dimension. And, you know, both of us being German, we, of course, have to cite the German Constitutional Court. And, you know, I want to push you a bit on the legal constraints first, because the German Constitutional Court is currently debating the recovery fund. And the selling point for the current EU recovery fund was that it's a one-off, so it doesn't permanently commit resources over which the Bundestag, the German parliament, has authority. And of course, the other important legal argument is that it's born out of a sort of natural disaster catastrophe, so Article 122, so really an emergency situation during which such lending and borrowing is actually allowed. So you say, well, we should perhaps make that something like a permanent feature of Europe's monetary union. I think most economists agree with that statement. But how do we get there, given the legal constraints?
First of all, it's completely correct that the current recovery fund is a one-off instrument. The way it has been constructed, the way it's set up, is one-off. The Commission cannot just go on and borrow more money. It's impossible. It's really legally not possible. So in that sense, it's really a one-off opportunity. And politically, if we want the EU to have the capacity to invest in future crises, to stabilize our economies, we all know that one important condition is that the current recovery fund will be spent well. If we can prove that the money, the 750 billion, will really help to transform our economies, make Europe stronger, and support our societies, then I think we will be able to make a point for saying we should have such an instrument for future crises as well, be they natural, be it the climate crisis, whatever crisis we will face. But to get there, I think it's really important that all the member states now spend the money well, that they really invest in climate protection, in digitalization, in their health infrastructure, do take necessary reforms, and see the opportunity for strengthening the euro as such afterwards. So that's, I think, you know, how to get there, spend the current money well. And secondly, when it comes to the legal question, I'm like, the construct has not just been built on the emergency question, it has been built on the EU budget. And I think that's the important part. And we will see how Karlsruhe will judge it. But I think it's important really to say it is one way of income into the EU budget that should become normalized in a sense, but that you need always, of course, to link to strong parliamentary control, which currently we don't have, and where you need very tight, of course, as well, substantive conditions on what it can be spent. And for us, the priorities would always be European public goods, in contrast to the current recovery fund. The current recovery fund is very nationally. Italy is spending the money for Italian projects, Germany is spending it for German projects, etc. And what we envisage is more that you do really invest in European public goods, e.g. energy infrastructure, train infrastructure, the real European infrastructure we need, the digital infrastructure, talking about cloud infrastructure, batteries, etc., the real big challenges that we need to address jointly. So that would be different from the current setting and give it more a European added value to tackle future crises and future challenges. And how do we get the political majorities for that? I'm fighting for it every day and I'm trying to convince as many citizens as I can. So we'll see. But as I said, I hope that the current recovery fund will be spent well.
Indeed, I think all the points you make really a lot of sense. But can I ask you on the parliamentary control? You mentioned the parliamentary control is an important element of democratic accountability and acceptability of such an instrument. When you say parliamentary control, do you have in mind the European Parliament actually having the budgetary powers, or do you have in mind national parliaments doing the job?
We need to strengthen both sides of the parliament. I'm never arguing one against the other. But if we look at the German Constitutional Court, it is judging the recovery fund on two dimensions. One is the so-called national identity, the core of our democracy, which is, e.g., the power of the Bundestag to decide for, you know, when it comes to the budget. And then the second one is on the so-called ultra vires, if the EU actually has the competences to do this. And we should take the first dimension serious because it has this very important notion of democratic legitimacy of all decision making. And Karlsruhe has a point in saying if the Bundestag as an elected body has less to say on the spending of this, then another parliament needs to have more control over it. You cannot just give it all the way time to the executive. And if we take that serious, and I think that's a point that is valid, then we need to strengthen the European Parliament when it comes to decision-making on how the money is spent and on the control, the follow-up, if it's managed well. And I think the important question will also be the role of the German Bundestag will depend on where the money to pay it back comes from. For example, if we do introduce more European-generated income via a European border adjustment mechanism that we talked about before, or the emission trading scheme, or a digital tax, etc., then we, of course, also need the European Parliament on this. But I still always foresee a role also for the national parliaments, as long as the money for the European budget comes from the German budget as an income. Then, of course, the German parliament needs to vote on this. I see that totally perfectly okay. It's German taxpayers' money, and the Bundestag can decide to give this money to the European level, but it's the German Bundestag that decides that.
Yes, so I think that is, of course, a difficult proposition if the main money comes from the national taxpayers and any national parliament can, at any time, every 5 or 7 years, block this EU level. So politically, it can be quite tricky. Imagine Bavaria could block the Bundestag decisions on the EU budget just because, after all, the taxpayers' money is collected in Bavaria, right? It's not just collected at the federal level, so it's collected in the states. So I find that a difficult proposition for a real European public good and European level of fiscal policy.
That's why, you know, we are arguing for new own resources in terms of carbon adjustment mechanism, etc., for taxes that you can actually better tax on a European level than on a national level, where it perfectly makes sense to say we do this on a European scale and not on a national scale. But I really defend the idea that when it comes to the national contributions, you need to have an okay by the national parliaments for that. And I also think, you know, if you have a blockade and you go ahead with fewer member states, I thought it was very important in the fall that when Orban and Kaczynski were ready to derail the entire recovery package because they didn't want to accept the idea that European money is conditioned on the respect for the rule of law, I thought the main difference was made when the European Commission said, we can actually propose a proposal at 25. If you don't need any assistance in this crisis and believe you can get through fine, okay, you are welcome. Do it without European solidarity. And I think that was the lesson for me learned is that, you know, in the worst case, we go ahead with those that are willing to do it and are willing to live the solidarity we need on the European continent. So in that sense, I wouldn't see it being blocked by every single member state because I would be ready to go ahead with fewer than 27. But those 27 there, when the constitution foresees it, and in Germany it's clearly so, need then a national parliament's approval for the spending, as long as the money comes from the national budget. And maybe one thought on this. I really think it will be important that the European Parliament is strengthened in the role of the budget negotiations, that it doesn't just have a say in the end in terms of yes or no. Then I think that would certainly lead to more European goods being financed. Because that's another lesson from the last year's negotiations is that with the 4 or 5 countries that were not ready to support the recovery fund from the beginning, that de facto the negotiations led to cutting of the European projects and no cutting of the national spending. And that was a real shame.
It was a real shame indeed. Before we conclude, let's talk for 1 minute about the capital market side and banking side of the international role of the euro. I think most economists know and agree that a strong currency does not only require fiscal policy and, you know, strong monetary policy, it also requires deep and liquid capital markets. And there, of course, Europe is not doing terribly well. Our capital markets are fragmented and are actually relatively small, which, by the way, is an issue not just for the currency, it's also an issue for funding innovation, funding digital projects, which often need risk capital that banks are typically not ready to provide. So where do you see your role, your party's role, Germany's position on this evolving? How can we strengthen Europe's capital markets to, you know, get a more dynamic economy, but also a stronger euro?
Yes, very important point. We need to really, as you said, the capital market is not really a unified capital market. So we need to get rid of the hurdles that we have had for years, decades. The same is true for the banking union. It looks like we're getting there, but it's still not yet really finished or finalized. And we also need to make sure that we go into the new areas, fintech, etc., green fintech, etc. And we're seeing rather with worry that this is developed rather in China than in Europe, and that we have a big interest in making sure that European actors are growing and existing and up on the agenda. This won't happen, in our view, without some support from the EU, from member states. But it's often overlooked what's happening in this area these days. And I definitely believe we should pay more attention to it. The euro as a digital currency, there are many dimensions of this where if we want to have a more international role, we really have to wake up and get to the forefront of the debate. By the way, it's an interesting one on the crossroad of digital sovereignty and financial sovereignty, the entire fintech area, where I think we are currently rather losing out than catching up.
Well, I would love to discuss with you now the digitalization of the euro and the various projects that the ECB has in mind. But I'm afraid this would take us too far and our time is already running up. Franziska Brandner, thank you so much for joining us in today's podcast. And thank you to all of our listeners for listening to this podcast. Please join us on our webpage on www.bruegel.org. And do tweet and promote this podcast if you liked it on your various social media feeds. Thank you again.
Thank you.